at the top of our Gravesend Academy graduating class, the first time a New Hampshire resident had achieved such distinction. "Competing against the nation's best, Gravesend native wins," was the headline in the Gravesend newsletter. The story appeared in many of New Hampshire's papers. The University of New Hampshire never imagined that Owen would accept the scholarship. Indeed, the Honor Society scholarship was offered every year to New Hampshire's best, with the tragic understanding that the recipient would probably go to Harvard or Yale or to some other better school. It was obvious to me that Owen would be accepted and offered full scholarships at Harvard and Yale. Hester was the only reason he might accept the scholarship to the University of New Hampshire, and what would be the point of that? Owen would begin his university career in the fall of 62, and Hester would graduate in the spring of 63.
"You might at least try to get into a better university," Owen told me.
I was not asking him to give up Harvard or Yale to keep me company at the University of New Hampshire. I thought it was unfair of him to expect me to go through the motions of applying to Harvard and Yale just to experience the rejections. Although Owen had substantially improved my abilities as a student, he could do little to improve my mediocre college board scores. I simply wasn't Harvard or Yale material. I had become a good student in English and history courses. I was a slow but thorough reader, and I could write a readable, well-organized paper. But Owen was still holding my hand through the math and science courses, and I still plodded my dim way through foreign languages. As a student, I would never be what Owen was, a natural. Yet he was cross with me for accepting that I could do no better than the University of New Hampshire. In truth, I liked the University of New Hampshire. Durham, the town, was no more threatening than Gravesend, and it was near enough to Gravesend so that I could continue to see a lot of Dan and Grandmother. I could even continue to live with them.
"I'm sure I'll end up in Durham, too,"
Owen said, with just the smallest touch of self-pity in his voice. But it infuriated me.
"I don't see how I can let you fend for yourself," he added.
"I'm perfectly capable of fending for myself," I said, "and I'll come visit you at Harvard or Yale."
"No, we'll both make other friends. We'll drift apart. That's the way it happens," he said philosophically. "And you're no letter writer. You don't even keep a diary," he added.
"If you lower your standards and come to the University of New Hampshire for my sake, I'll kill you," I told him.
"There are also my parents to consider," he said. "If I were in school at Durham, I could still live at home and look after them."
"What do you need to look after them for?" I asked him. It appeared to me that he spent as little time with his parents as possible.
"And there's also Hester to consider," he added.
"Let me get one thing straight," I said to him. "You and Hester, it seems to be the most on-again, off-again thing. Are you even sleeping with her? Have you ever slept with her?"
"For someone your age and of your education, you're awfully crude," Owen said.
When he got up off the basketball court, he was limping. I passed him the basketball. He passed it back. The idiot janitor reset the scorer's clock. The numbers were brightly lit and huge. 4 seconds. That's what the clock said. I was so sick of it. I held the ball. He held out his hands.
"Ready?"
Owen said. On that word, the janitor started the clock. I passed Owen the ball. He jumped into my hands. I lifted him. He reached higher and higher and, pivoting in the air, stuffed the stupid basketball through the hoop. He was so precise he never touched the rim. He was midair, returning to earth, his hands still above his head but empty, his eyes on the scorer's clock at midcourt when he shouted,
"Time!"
The janitor stopped the clock. That was when I would turn to look. Usually, our time had expired. 0 seconds. But this time, when I looked, there was 1 second left on the clock. 1 second. He had sunk the shot in under 4 seconds.
"You see what a little faith can do?"
said Owen Meany. The brain-damaged janitor was applauding.
"Set the clock to 3 seconds,
Owen told him. "Jesus Christ," I said.
"If we can do it in under 4 seconds, we can do it in under 3, he said. "It just takes a little more faith."
"It takes more practice," I told him irritably.
"Faith takes practice," said Owen Meany.
1961 was the first year of our friendship that was marred by unfriendly criticism and quarreling. Our most basic dispute began in the fall, when we returned to the academy for our senior year, and one of the privileges extended to seniors at Gravesend was responsible for an argument that left Owen and me feeling especially uneasy. As seniors, we were permitted to take the train to Boston on either Wednesday or Saturday afternoon. We had no classes on those afternoons. And if we told the dean's office where we were going, we were allowed to return to Gravesend on the Boston and Main, as late as 10 p.m. on the same day. As day boys, Owen and I didn't really have to be back to school until the Thursday morning meeting, or the Sunday service at Hurd's Church, if we chose to go to Boston on a Saturday. Even on a Saturday, Dan and my grandmother frowned upon the idea of our spending most of the night in the dreaded city. There was a so-called milk train that left Boston at 2 o'clock in the morning. It stopped at every town between Boston and Gravesend, and it didn't get us home until 6:30 a.m., about the time the school dining hall opened for breakfast. But Dan and my grandmother said that Owen and I should live this wildly on only the most special occasions. Mr. and Mrs. Meany didn't make any rules for Owen at all. Owen was content to abide by the rules Dan and grandmother made for me. But he was not content to spend his time in the dreaded city in the manner that most Gravesend seniors spent their time. Many Gravesend graduates attended Harvard. A typical outing for a Gravesend senior began with a subway ride to Harvard Square. There, with the use of a fake draft card or with the assistance of an older Gravesend graduate now attending Harvard, booze was purchased in abundance and consumed with abandon. Sometimes, albeit rarely, girls were met. Fortified by the former, and never in the company of the latter, our senior class then rode the subway back to Boston, where, once again falsifying our age, we gained admission to the striptease performances that were much admired by our age group at an establishment known as Old Freddy's. I saw nothing that was morally offensive in this rite of passage. At 19, I was a virgin. Caroline O'Day had not permitted the advance of even so much as my hand, at least not more than an inch or so above the hem of her pleated skirt or her matching burgundy knee socks. And although Owen had told me that it was only Caroline's Catholicism that prevented me access to her favors,
especially in her St. Michael's uniform,
I had been no more successful with Police Chief Ben Pike's daughter, Lorna, who was not Catholic and not wearing a uniform of any kind, when I snagged my lip on her braces. Apparently, it was either my blood or my pain, or both, that disgusted her with me. At 19, to experience lust, even in its shabbiest forms at Old Freddy's, was at least to experience something. And if Owen and I had at first imagined what love was at the Idaho, I saw nothing wrong in lusting at a burlesque show. Owen, I imagined, was not a virgin. How could he have remained a virgin with Hester? So I found it sheer hypocrisy for him to label Old Freddy's
disgusting
and
degrading.
At 19, I drank infrequently and entirely for the maturing thrill of becoming drunk. But Owen Meany didn't drink. He disapproved of losing control. Furthermore, he had interpreted Kennedy's inaugural charge to do something for his country in a typically single-minded and literal fashion. He would falsify no more draft cards. He would produce no more fake identification to assist the illegal drinking and burlesque show attendance of his peers, and he was loudly self-righteous about his decision, too. Fake draft cards were
wrong,
he had decided. Therefore, we walked soberly around Harvard Square, a part of Cambridge that is not necessarily enhanced by sobriety. Soberly, We looked up our former Gravesend schoolmates, and, soberly, I imagined the Harvard community and how it might be morally altered with Owen Meany in residence. One of our former schoolmates even told us that Harvard was a depressing experience, when sober. But Owen insisted that our journeys to the dreaded city be conducted as joyless research. And so they were. To maintain sobriety and to attend the striptease performances at Old Freddy's was a form of unusual torture. The women at Old Freddy's were only watchable to the blind drunk. Since Owen had made fake draft cards for himself and me before his lofty, Kennedy-inspired resolution not to break the law, we used the cards to be admitted to Old Freddy's.
"This is disgusting," Owen said.
We watched a heavy-breasted woman in her 40s remove her pasties with her teeth. She then spat them into the eager audience.
"This is degrading," Owen said.
We watched another unfortunate pick up a tangerine from the dirty floor of the stage. She lifted the tangerine almost to knee level by picking it up from the floor with the labia of her vulva. But she could raise it no higher. She lost her grip on the tangerine, and it rolled off the stage and into the crowd, where two or three of our schoolmates fought over it. Of course it was
disgusting
and
degrading.
We were sober.
"Let's find a nice part of town,"
Owen said. "And do what?" I asked him.
"Look at it,"
Owen said. It occurs to me now that most of the seniors at Gravesend Academy had grown up looking at the nice parts of towns. But quite apart from stronger motives, Owen Meany was interested in what that was like. That was how we ended up on Newbury Street, one Wednesday afternoon in the fall of 61. I know now that it was
no accident
that we ended up there. There were some art galleries on Newbury Street, and some very posh stores selling pricey antiques, and some very fancy clothing stores. There was a movie theater around the corner on Exeter Street, where they were showing a foreign film. Not the kind of thing that was regularly shown in the vicinity of Old Freddy's. At the Exeter, they were showing movies you had to read, the kind with subtitles.
"Jesus," I said. "What are we going to do here?"
"You're so unobservant," Owen said.
He was looking at a mannequin in a storefront window, a disturbingly faceless mannequin, severely modern for the period in that she was bald. The mannequin wore a hip-length, silky blouse. The blouse was fire engine red, and it was cut along the sexy lines of a camisole. The mannequin wore nothing else. Owen stared at her.
"This is really great," I said to him. "We come 2 hours on the train. We're going to ride 2 more hours to get back, and here you are staring at another dressmaker's dummy. If that's all you want to do, you don't even have to leave your own bedroom."
"Notice anything familiar?" he asked me.
The name of the store, Gerald's, was painted in vivid red letters across the window in a flourishing, handwritten style. Gerald's.
"Gerald's," I said. "So what's familiar?"
He put his little hand in his pocket and brought out the label he had removed from my mother's old red dress. It was the dummy's red dress, really, because my mother had hated it. It was
familiar,
what the label said. Gerald's. Everything I could see in the store's interior was the same vivid shade of fire engine poinsettia red.
"She said the store burned down, didn't she?" I asked Owen.
"She also said she couldn't remember the store's name, that she had to ask people in the neighborhood," Owen said. "But the name was on the label. It was always on the back of the dress."
With a shudder, I thought again about my Aunt Martha's assertion that my mother was a little simple. No one had ever said she was a liar. "She said there was a lawyer who told her she could keep the dress," I said. "She said that everything burned, didn't she?"
"Bills of sale were burned, inventory was burned, stock was burned. That's what she said,"
Owen said.
The telephone melted. Remember that part? I asked him.
The cash register melted? Remember that?
He asked me. Maybe they rebuilt the place after the fire, I said. Maybe there was another store. Maybe there's a chain of stores. He didn't say anything. We both knew it was unlikely that the public's interest in the color red would support a chain of stores like Gerald's. How'd you know the store was here? I asked Owen.
I saw an advertisement in the Sunday Boston Herald, he said. I was looking for the funnies, and I recognized the handwriting. It was the same style as the label.
Leave it to Owen to recognize the handwriting. He had probably studied the label in my mother's red dress for so many years that he could have written Gerald's in the exact same style himself.
What are we waiting for? Owen asked me. Why don't we go inside and ask them if they ever had a fire?
Inside the place, we were confronted by a spareness as eccentric as the glaring color of every article of clothing in sight. If Gerald's could be said to have a theme, it appeared to be, stated and overstated, that there was only one of everything. One bra, one nightgown, one half-slip, one little cocktail dress, one long evening dress, one long skirt, one short skirt, the one blouse on the one mannequin we had seen in the window, and one counter of four-sided glass that contained a single pair of red leather gloves, a pair of red high heels, a garnet necklace with a matching pair of earrings, and one very thin belt, also red, and probably alligator or lizard. The walls were white, the hoods of the indirect lights were black, and the one man behind the one counter was about the age my mother would have been if she'd been alive. The man regarded Owen and me disdainfully. He saw two teenage boys, not dressed for Newbury Street, possibly, if so pathetically, shopping for a mother or for a girlfriend. I doubt that we could have afforded even the cheapest version of the color red available in Gerald's.
Did you ever have a fire?
Owen asked the man. Now the man looked less sure about us. He thought we were too young to be selling insurance, but Owen's question, not to mention Owen's voice, had disarmed him.
It would have been a fire in the 40s, I said.
Or the early 50s, said Owen Meany.
Perhaps you haven't been here at this location for that long? I asked the man.
Are you Gerald?
Owen asked the man. Like a miniature policeman, Owen Meany pushed the wrinkled label from my mother's dress across the glass-topped counter.
That's our label, the man said, fingering the evidence cautiously. We've been here since before the war, but I don't think we've ever had a fire. What sort of fire do you mean? He asked Owen, because naturally Owen appeared to be in charge.
Are you Gerald?
Owen repeated.
That's my father, Giordano, the man said. He was Giovanni Giordano, but they fucked around with his name when he got off the boat.
This was an immigration story, and not the story Owen and I were interested in. So I asked the man politely, "Is your father alive?"
"Hey, Papa!" the man shouted. "You alive?"
A white door, fitted so flush to the white wall that Owen and I had not noticed it was there, opened. An old man with a tailor's measuring tape around his neck and a tailor's many pins adorning the lapels of his vest came into the storeroom.
"Of course I'm alive," he said. "You waiting for some miracle? You in a hurry for your inheritance?"
He had a mostly Boston, somewhat Italian accent.
"Papa, these young men want to talk to Gerald about some fire," the son said.
He spoke laconically and with a more virulent Boston accent than his father's.
"What fire?" Mr. Giordano asked us.
"We were told that your store burned down sometime in the 40s or the 50s," I said.
"This is big news to me," said Mr. Giordano.
"My mother must have made a mistake," I explained. I showed the old label to Mr. Giordano. "She bought a dress in your store sometime in the 40s or the 50s. I didn't know what else to say. "It was a red dress,"
I added.
No kidding, said the son.
I said, I wish I had a picture of her. Perhaps I could come back with a photograph. You might remember something about her if I showed you a picture, I said.
Does she want the dress altered?
The old man asked me.
I don't mind making alterations, but she's got to come into the store herself. I don't do alterations from pictures.
She's dead,
said Owen Meany. His tiny hand went into his pocket again. He brought out a neatly folded envelope. In the envelope was the picture my mother had given him. It was a wedding picture, very pretty of her and not bad of Dan. My mother had included the photo with a thank-you note to Owen and his father for their unusual wedding present.
I just happen to have brought a picture,
Owen said, handing the sacred object to Mr. Giordano.
Frank Sinatra, the old man cried.
His son took the picture from him.
That don't look like Frank Sinatra to me, the son said.
No, no, the old man cried. He grabbed the photo back.
She loved those Sinatra songs. She sang 'em real good, too. We used to talk about Frankie Boy. Your mother said he should have been a woman. He had such a pretty voice, Mr. Giordano said.
Do you know why she bought the dress?
Owen asked.
Sure, I know, the old man told us. It was the dress she always sung in. I need something to sing in. That's what she said when she walked in here. I need something not like me. That's what she said. I'll never forget her. But I didn't know who she was. Not when she came in here, not then, Mr. Giordano said.
Who the fuck was she? The son asked. I shuddered to hear him ask. It had just occurred to me that I didn't know who my mother was either.
She was the lady in red. Don't you remember her?
Mr. Giordano asked his son. She was still singing in that place when you got home from the war. What was that place? The son grabbed the photo back.
It's her, he cried. The lady in red,
the Giordanos cried together. I was trembling. My mother was a singer in some joint. She was someone called the lady in red. She'd had a career in nightlife. I looked at Owen. He appeared strangely at ease. He was almost calm, and he was smiling.
Isn't this more interesting than old Freddy's? Owen asked me.
What the Giordanos told us was that my mother had been a female vocalist at a supper club on Beacon Street.
A perfectly proper sort of place, the old man assured us.
There was a black pianist. He played an old-fashioned piano, which, the Giordanos explained, meant that he played the old tunes, and quietly.
So's you could hear the singer!
It was not a place where single men or women went. It was not a bar. It was a supper club. And a supper club, the Giordanos assured us, was a restaurant with live entertainment.
Something relaxed enough to digest to.
About 10 o'clock, the singer and pianist served up music more suitable for dancing than for dinner table conversation, and there was dancing then until midnight. Men with their wives, or at least with serious dates. It was
no place to take a floozy, or to find one.
And most nights there was a sort of famous female vocalist, someone you would have heard of. Although Owen Meany and I had never heard of anyone that Giordano's mentioned. The lady in red sang only one night a week. The Giordanos had forgotten which night, but Owen and I could provide that information. It would have been Wednesday, always Wednesday. Supposedly the singing teacher my mother was studying with was so famous that he had time for her only on Thursday mornings, and so early that she had to spend the previous night in the dreaded city. Why she never sang under her own name, why she was always the lady in red, the Giordanos didn't know. Nor could they recall the name of the supper club. They just knew it wasn't there anymore. It had always had the look of a private home. Now it had, in fact, become one.
Somewheres on Beacon Street.
That was all they could remember. It was either a private home or doctor's offices.
As for the owner of the club, he was a Jewish fellow from Miami. The Giordanos had heard that the man had gone back to Miami.
"I guess they still have supper clubs down there,"
old Mr. Giordano said. He was sad and shocked to hear that my mother was dead. The lady in red had become quite popular among the local patrons of the club. Not famous, not like some of the others, but a kind of regular feature of the place. The Giordanos remembered that she had come and that she had gone away for a while, and then she'd come back. Later, she had gone away for good, but people didn't believe it, and they would say for years that she was coming back again. When she'd been away for a while, that was when she'd been having me, of course. The Giordanos could almost remember the name of the black pianist. "He was there as long as the place was there," they said. But the closest they could come to the man's name was Buster.
"Big Black Buster," Mr. Giordano said.
"I don't think he was from Miami," the son said.
"Clearly,"
said Owen Meany, when we were once more out on Newbury Street,
"Big Black Buster is not your father."
I wanted to ask Owen if he still had the name and address, and even the phone number, of my mother's singing and voice teacher. I knew Mother had given the particulars to Owen, and I doubted that Owen would have discarded anything she gave him. But I didn't have to ask. Once more, his tiny hand shot into his pocket.
"The address is in the neighborhood," he told me. "I made an appointment to have my voice analyzed. When the guy heard my voice over the phone, he said he'd give me an appointment whenever I wanted one."
Thus had Owen Meany come to Boston, the dreaded city. He had come prepared. There were some elegant townhouses along the most densely tree-lined part of Commonwealth Avenue where Graham McSwiney, the voice and singing teacher, lived. But Mr. McSwiney had a small and cluttered walk-up apartment in one of the less restored old houses that had been divided and subdivided almost as many times as the collective rent of the various tenants had been withheld or paid late. Since we were early for Owen's appointment, we sat in a corridor outside Mr. McSwiney's apartment door, on which was posted, by a thumbtack, a hand-lettered sign, "Don't knock or ring bell if you hear singing." Singing was not quite what we heard, but some sort of exercise was in progress behind Mr. McSwiney's closed door, and so Owen and I didn't knock or ring the bell. We sat on a comfortable but odd piece of furniture, not a couch, but what appeared to be a seat removed from a public bus, and listened to the singing or voice lesson we were forbidden to disturb. A man's powerful, resonant voice said,
"Me, me, 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 me."
A woman's absolutely thrilling voice repeated,
"Me, me, 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 me."
Then the man said,
"No, no, 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 no."
And the woman answered,
"No, no, 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 no."
And then the man sang just a line from a song. It was a song from My Fair Lady, the one that goes, "All I want is a room somewhere." And the woman sang,
"Far away from the cold night air."
And together they sang,
"With one enormous chair."
And the woman took it by herself.
"Oh, wouldn't it be lovely?"
"Me, me, 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 me,"
said the man again. Now a piano was involved. Just one key. Their voices, even in this silly exercise, were the most wonderful voices Owen Meany and I had heard, even when she sang,
"No, no, 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 no."
The woman's voice was much more beautiful than my mother's. I was glad that Owen and I had to wait, because it gave me time to be grateful for at least this part of our discovery, that Mr. McSwiney really was a voice and singing teacher, and that he seemed to have a perfectly wonderful voice, and that he had a pupil with an even better voice than my mother's. This at least meant that something I thought I knew about my mother was true. The shock of our discovery in Gerald's needed time to sink in. It did not strike me that my mother's lie about the red dress was a devastating sort of untruth. Even that she had been an actual singer, an actual performer, didn't strike me as such an awful thing for her to have hidden from me, or even from Dan, if she'd kept Dan in the dark too. What struck me was my memory of how easily and gracefully she had told that little lie about the store burning down, how she had fretted so convincingly about the red dress. Quite probably, it occurred to me, she had been a better liar than a singer. And if she'd lied about the dress and had never told anyone in her life in Gravesend about the lady in red, what else had she lied about? In addition to not knowing who my father was, what else didn't I know? Owen Meany, who thought much more quickly than I did, put it very simply. He whispered, so that he wouldn't disturb Mr. McSwiney's lesson.
"Now you don't know who your mother is, either," Owen said.
Following the exit of a small, flamboyantly dressed woman from Mr. McSwiney's apartment, Owen and I were admitted to the teacher's untidy hovel. The disappointingly small size of the departing singer's bosom was a contradiction to the power we had heard in her voice, but we were impressed by the air of professional disorder that greeted us in Graham McSwiney's studio. There was no door on the cubicle bathroom, in which the bathtub appeared to be hastily, even comically, placed. It was detached from the plumbing, and full of the elbow joints of pipes and their fittings. A plumbing project was clearly in progress there, and progressing at no great pace. There was no wall, or the wall had been taken down, between the cubicle kitchen and the living room, and there were no doors on the kitchen cabinets, which revealed little besides coffee cups and mugs, suggesting that Mr. McSwiney either restricted himself to an all-caffeine diet or that he took his meals elsewhere. And there was no bed in the living room, the only real room in the tiny, crowded apartment, suggesting that the couch, which was covered with sheet music, concealed a fold-away bed. But the placement of the sheet music had the look of meticulous specificity, and the sheer volume of it argued that the couch was never sat upon, not to mention unfolded, and this evidence suggested that Mr. McSwiney slept elsewhere, too. Everywhere there were mementos, playbills from opera houses and concert halls, newspaper clippings of people singing, and framed citations and medals hung on ribbons, suggesting Golden Throat awards of an almost athletic order of recognition. Everywhere, too, were framed, poster-sized drawings of the chest and throat, as clinical in detail as the drawings in Gray's Anatomy, and as simplistic in their arrangement around the apartment as the educational diagrams in certain doctors' offices. Beneath these anatomical drawings were the kind of optimistic slogans that gung-ho coaches hang in gyms.
Begin with the breastbone. Keep upper chest filled with air all the time. The diaphragm is a one-way muscle. It can only inhale. Practice your breathing separately from your singing. Never lift your shoulders. Never hold your breath.
One whole wall was devoted to instructive commands regarding vowels. Over the doorway of the bathroom was the single exclamation, "Gently." Dominating the apartment from the center stage of the living room, big and black and perfectly polished, and conceivably worth twice the annual rent on Mr. McSwiney's place of business, was the piano. Mr. McSwiney was completely bald. Wild, white tufts of hair sprang from his ears, as if to protect him from the volume of his own huge voice. He was hardy-looking, in his 60s, or even in his 70s, a short, muscular man whose chest descended to his belt, or whose round, hard belly consumed his chest and rested under his chin, like a beer-drinker's boulder.
"So, which one of you's got the voice?" Mr. McSwiney asked us.
"I have," said Owen Meany.
"You certainly have," cried Mr. McSwiney,
who paid little attention to me, even when Owen took special pains to introduce me by putting unmistakable emphasis on my last name, which we thought might be familiar to the singing and voice teacher.
"This is my friend, John Wheelwright," Owen said.
But Mr. McSwiney couldn't wait to have a look at Owen's Adam's apple. The name Wheelwright appeared to ring no bells for him.
"It's all the same thing, whatever you call it," Mr. McSwiney said. "An Adam's apple, a larynx, a voice box. It's the most important part of the vocal apparatus," he explained,
sitting Owen in what he called the singer's seat, which was a plain, straight-back chair directly in front of the piano. Mr. McSwiney put his thumb and index finger on either side of Owen's Adam's apple.
"Swallow,"
he instructed. Owen swallowed. When I held my own Adam's apple and swallowed, I could feel my Adam's apple jump higher up my neck, but Owen's Adam's apple hardly moved.
"Yawn,"
said Mr. McSwiney. When I yawned, my Adam's apple moved down my neck, but Owen Meany's Adam's apple stayed almost exactly where it was.
"Scream,"
said Mr. McSwiney.
"Ah!"
said Owen Meany. Again, his Adam's apple hardly moved.
"Amazing," said Mr. McSwiney. "You've got a permanently fixed larynx," he told Owen. "I've rarely seen such a thing," he said. "Your voice box is never in repose. Your Adam's apple sits up there in the position of a permanent scream. I could try giving you some exercises, but you might want to see a throat doctor. You might have to have surgery."
"I don't want to have surgery. I don't need any exercises," said Owen Meany. "If God gave me this voice, he had a reason," Owen said.
"How come his voice doesn't change?" I asked Mr. McSwiney, who seemed on the verge of a satirical remark regarding God's role in the position of Owen's voice box. "I thought every boy's voice changed at puberty," I said.
"If his voice hasn't changed already, it's probably never going to change," Mr. McSwiney said. "Vocal cords don't make words, they just vibrate. Vocal cords aren't really cords, they're just lips. It's the opening between those lips that's called the glottis. It's nothing but the act of breathing on the closed lips that makes a sound. When a male voice changes, it's just a part of puberty. It's called a secondary sexual development. But I don't think your voice is going to change," Mr. McSwiney told Owen. "If it was going to change, it would have."
"That doesn't explain why it already hasn't," said Owen Meany.
"I can't explain that," Mr. McSwiney admitted. "I can give you some exercises," he repeated, "or I can recommend a doctor."
"I don't expect my voice to change," said Owen Meany.
I could see that Mr. McSwiney was learning how exasperating Owen's belief in God's plans could be.
"Why'd you come to see me, kid?" Mr. McSwiney asked him.
"Because you know his mother,"
Owen said, pointing to me. Graham McSwiney assessed me, as if he feared I might represent an elderly paternity suit. "Tabitha Wheelwright," I said. "She was called Tabby. She was from New Hampshire, and she studied with you in the 40s and the 50s, from before I was born until I was 8 or 9.
"Or 10,
said Owen Meany. Into his pocket went his hand again. He handed Mr. McSwiney the photograph.
"The lady in red," Mr. McSwiney said.
"I'm sorry, I forgot her name," he told me.
"But you remember her?" I asked.
"Oh, sure, I remember her," he said. "She was pretty and very pleasant, and I got her that silly job. It wasn't much of a gig, but she had fun doing it. She had this idea that someone might discover her if she kept singing there, but I told her no one ever got discovered in Boston, and certainly not in that supper club."
Mr. McSwiney explained that the club often called him and rated his students for local talent. As the Giordanos had told us, the club hired more established female vocalists for gigs that lasted for a month or more, but on Wednesdays, the club rested their stars. That's when they called upon local talent.
In my mother's case, she had gained a small neighborhood reputation, and the club had made a habit of her. She'd not wanted to use her name, a form of shyness or provincialism that Mr. McSwiney found as silly as her idea that anyone might discover her.
"But she was charming," he said. "As a singer, she was all head, she had no chest, and she was lazy. She liked to perform simple, popular songs. She wasn't very ambitious, and she wouldn't practice."
He explained the two sets of muscles involved in a head voice and in a chest voice. Although this was not what interested Owen and me about my mother, we were polite and allowed Mr. McSwiney to elaborate on his teacher's opinion of her. Most women sing with the larynx in a high position, or with only what Mr. McSwiney called a head voice. They experience a lack of power from the E above middle C downward, and when they try to hit their high notes loudly, they hit them shrilly. The development of a chest voice in women is very important. For men, it is the head voice that needs the development. For both, they must be willing to devote hours. My mother, a once-a-week singer, was what Mr. McSwiney called the vocal equivalent of a weekend tennis player. She had a pretty voice, as I've described it, but Mr. McSwiney's assessment of her voice was consistent with my memory of her. She did not have a strong voice. She was not ever as powerful as Mr. McSwiney's previous pupil had sounded to Owen and me through a closed door. "Who thought of the name, the Lady in Red?" I asked the old teacher, in an effort to steer him back to what interested us.
"She found a red dress in a store," Mr. McSwiney said. "She told me she wanted to be wholly out of character, but only once a week," he laughed. "I never went to hear her perform," he said. "It was just a supper club," he explained. "Really, no one who sang there was very good. Some of the better ones would work with me, so I heard them here, but I never set foot in the place. I knew Meyerson on the telephone. I don't remember that I actually met him. I think Meyerson called her the Lady in Red."
"Meyerson?" I asked.
"He owned the club. He was a nice old guy, from Miami, I think. He was honest and unpretentious. The singers I sent to him all liked him. They said he treated them respectfully," Mr. McSwiney said.
"Do you remember the name of the club?"
Owen asked him. It had been called the Orange Grove. My mother had joked to Mr. McSwiney about the decor, which she said was dotted everywhere with potted orange trees and tanks full of tropical fish, and husbands and wives celebrating their anniversaries. Yet she had imagined she might be discovered there.
"Did she have a boyfriend?"
Owen asked Mr. McSwiney, who shrugged.
"She wasn't interested in me. That's all I know," he said.
He smiled at me fondly.
"I know because I made a pass at her," he explained. "She handled it very nicely, and I never tried it again," he said.
"There was a pianist, a black pianist, at the Orange Grove," I said.
"You bet there was. But he was all over. He played all over town for years before he ended up there, and after he left there, he played all over town again," Mr. McSwiney said. "Big black Buster Freebody," he said, and laughed.
"Freebody?" I said.
"It was as made up a name as the Lady in Red," said Mr. McSwiney. "And he wouldn't have been your mother's boyfriend either. Buster was as queer as a cat fart."
Graham McSwiney also told us that Meyerson had gone back to Miami, but Mr. McSwiney added that Meyerson was old. Even in the 40s and 50s, he'd been old. He was so old that he'd have to be dead now.
"Or at least lying down on a shuffleboard court."
As for Buster Freebody, Mr. McSwiney couldn't remember where the big black man had played after the Orange Grove had seen its days.
"I used to run into him in so many places," Mr. McSwiney said. "I was as used to seeing Buster as a light fixture."
Buster Freebody had played what Mr. McSwiney called a real soft piano. Singers liked him because they could be heard over him.
"She had some trouble, your mother," Mr. McSwiney remembered. "She went away for a while, and then she came back again, and then she went away for good.
He was the trouble,
said Owen Meany, pointing to me.
Are you looking for your father? The singing teacher asked me. Is that it?
Yes, I said.
Don't bother, kid, said Mr. McSwiney. If he was looking for you, he would have found you.
God will tell him who his father is,
Owen said.
Graham McSwiney shrugged.
I'm not God, Mr. McSwiney said. This God, you know, he told Owen. This God must be pretty busy.
I gave him my phone number in Gravesend, in case he ever remembered the last place he'd heard Buster Freebody play the piano. Buster Freebody, Mr. McSwiney warned me, was old enough to be lying down on a shuffleboard court, too. Mr. McSwiney asked Owen Meany for his phone number, in case he ever heard a theory regarding why Owen's voice hadn't already changed.
It doesn't matter,
Owen said. But he gave Mr. McSwiney his number.
Your mother was a nice woman, a good person, a respectable woman, Mr. McSwiney told me.
Thank you, I said.
The Orange Grove was a stupid place, he told me. But it wasn't a dive. Nothing cheap would have happened to her there, he said.
Thank you, I said again.
All she ever sang was Sinatra stuff. It used to bore me to tears, Mr. McSwiney admitted.
I think we can assume that somebody liked to listen to it, said Owen Meany.
Toronto, May 30th, 1987. I should know better than to read even as much as a headline in the New York Times. Although, as I've often pointed out to my students at Bishop Strawn, this newspaper's use of the semicolon is exemplary. Reagan declares firmness on golf, semicolon. Plans are unclear. Isn't that a classic? I don't mean the semicolon. I mean, isn't that just what the world needs? Unclear firmness. That is typical American policy. Don't be clear, but be firm. In November 1961, after Owen Meany and I learned that his voice box was never in repose and that my mother had enjoyed or suffered a more secret life than we knew, General Maxwell Taylor reported to President Kennedy that U.S. military, economic, and political support could secure a victory for the South Vietnamese without the United States taking over the war. Privately, the general recommended sending 8,000 U.S. combat troops to Vietnam. That New Year's Eve, which Owen and Hester and I celebrated at 80 Front Street in the desultory manner that describes the partying habits of the late teen years, Hester was 20, and in a relatively quiet manner, because grandmother had gone to bed, there were only 3,205 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. Hester would usher in the new year more emphatically than Owen or I could manage. She greeted the new year on her knees, in the snow, in the rose garden, where grandmother would not hear her retching up her rum and coke, a concoction she had learned to fancy in the budding days of her romance in Tortola. I was less enthusiastic about the watershed changing of the year. I fell asleep, watching Charlton Heston's agonies in Ben-Hur. Somewhere between the chariot race and the leper colony, I nodded off. Owen watched the whole movie. During the commercials, he turned his detached attention to the window that overlooked the rose garden, where Hester's pale figure could be discerned in the ghostly glow of the moonlight against the snow. It is a wonder to me that the changing of the year had so little effect on Owen Meany, when I consider that he thought he knew, at the time, exactly how many years he had left. Yet he appeared content to watch Ben-Hur and Hester throwing up. Maybe that's what faith is. Exactly that contentment, even facing the future. By our next New Year's Eve together in 1962, there would be 11,300 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam, and once again, on the morning of New Year's Day, my grandmother would notice the frozen splatter of Hester's vomit in the snow, defacing that usually pristine area surrounding the birdbath in the center of the rose garden.
"Merciful heavens," grandmother would say, "what's all that mess around the birdbath?"
and just as he'd said the year before, Owen Meany said,
"Didn't you hear the birds last night, Mrs. Wheelwright? I'd better have a look at what Ethel's putting in your bird feeders."
Owen would have respected a book I read only 2 years ago, Vietnam War Almanac, by Colonel Harry G. Summers, Jr. Colonel Summers is a combat infantry veteran of Korea and Vietnam. He doesn't beat around the bush, as we used to say in Gravesend. Here is the first sentence of his very fine book. "One of the great tragedies of the Vietnam War is that although American armed forces defeated the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong in every major battle, the United States still suffered the greatest defeat in its history." Imagine that. On the first page of his book, Colonel Summers tells a story about President Franklin D. Roosevelt at the Yalta Conference in 1945, when the Allied powers were trying to decide the composition of the post-war world. President Roosevelt wanted to give Indochina to China's leader, General Chiang Kai-shek, but the general knew a little Vietnamese history and tradition. Chiang Kai-shek understood that the Vietnamese were not Chinese, and that they would never allow themselves to be comfortably absorbed by the Chinese people. To Roosevelt's generous offer to give him Indochina, Chiang replied, "We don't want it." Colonel Summers points out that it took the United States 30 years and a war that cost them nearly 50,000 American lives to find out what Chiang Kai-shek explained to President Roosevelt in 1945. Imagine that. Is it any surprise that President Reagan is promising firmness in the Persian Gulf and that his plans are unclear? Soon the school year will be over. Soon the BSS girls will be gone. It is hot and humid in the summer in Toronto, but I like to watch the sprinklers wetting down the grass on the St. Clair Reservoir. They keep Winston Churchill Park as green as a jungle all summer long. And the Reverend Catherine Keeling's family owns an island in Georgian Bay. Catherine always invites me to visit her. I usually go there at least once every summer, and so I get my annual fix of swimming in fresh water and fooling around with someone else's kids. Lots of wet life vests, lots of leaky canoes, and the smell of pine needles and wood preservative. A little of that lasts a long time for a fussy old bachelor like me. And in the summers, I go to Gravesend and visit with Dan, too. It would hurt Dan's feelings if I didn't come to see a theatrical performance of his Gravesend summer school students. He understands why I declined to see the performances of the Gravesend players. Mr. Fish is quite old, but still acting. Many of the town's older amateurs are still acting for Dan, but I'd just as soon not see them anymore. And I don't care for the view of the audience that, for a period of time, more than 20 years ago, intrigued Owen Meany and me.
"Is he out there tonight?"
Owen would whisper to me.
"Do you see him?"
In 1961, Owen and I searched the audience for that special face in the bleacher seats. Maybe a familiar face, and maybe not. We were looking for the man who responded, or did not respond, to my mother's wave. It was a face we were sure that would have registered some expression upon witnessing the results of Owen Meany making contact with that ball. It was a face we suspected that my mother would have seen in many audiences before, not just at Little League games, but staring out at her from the potted orange trees and the tanks full of tropical fish at the orange grove. We were looking for a face that the lady in red would have sung to at least once, if not many times.
"Do you see him?"
I would ask Owen Meany.
"Not tonight,"
Owen Meany would say.
"Either he's not here, or he's not thinking about your mother,"
he said one night. "What do you mean?" I asked him.
"Suppose Dan directed a play about Miami,"
Owen said.
"Suppose the Gravesend players put on a play about a supper club in Miami, and it was called the Orange Grove, and there was a singer called the Lady in Red, and she sang only the old Sinatra songs."
"But there is no play like that," I said.
"Just suppose,"
Owen said.
Use your imagination. God can tell you who your father is, but you have to believe it. You've got to give God a little help. Just suppose there was such a play.
Okay, I said. I'm supposing.
And we called the play either The Orange Grove or The Lady in Red. Don't you suppose that your father would come to see that play? And don't you suppose we could recognize him then?
Asked Owen Meany. I suppose so, I said. The problem was, Owen and I didn't dare tell Dan about The Orange Grove and The Lady in Red. We weren't sure that Dan didn't already know. I thought it would hurt Dan to know that he wasn't enough of a father to me, for wouldn't he interpret my curiosity regarding my biological father as an indication that he, Dan, was less than adequate in his adoptive role? And if Dan didn't know about The Orange Grove and The Lady in Red, wouldn't that hurt him too? It made my mother's past, before Dan, appear more romantic than I ever thought it had been. Why would Dan Needham want to dwell on my mother's romantic past? Owen suggested that there was a way to get the Gravesend Players to perform a play about a female vocalist in a Miami supper club without involving Dan in our discovery.
I could write the play, said Owen Meany. I could submit it to Dan as the first original production of the Gravesend Players. I could tell in 1 second if Dan already knew the story.
But you don't know the story, I pointed out to Owen. You don't have a story. You just have a setting and a very sketchy cast of characters.
It can't be very hard to make up a good story, said Owen Meany. Clearly, your mother had a talent for it, and she wasn't even a writer.
I suppose you're a writer, I said. Owen shrugged.
It can't be very hard, Owen repeated.
But I said I didn't want him to try it and take a chance of hurting Dan. If Dan already knew the story, even if he knew only the setting, he would be hurt, I said.
I don't think it's Dan you're worried about, said Owen Meany.
What do you mean, Owen? I asked him. He shrugged. Sometimes I think that Owen Meany invented shrugging.
I think you're afraid to find out who your father is, he said.
Fuck you, Owen, I said. He shrugged again.
Look at it this way, said Owen Meany. You've been given a clue. No effort from you was required. God has given you a clue. Now you have a choice. Either you use God's gift or you waste it. I think a little effort from you is required.
I think you care more about who my father is than I do, I told him. He nodded. It was the day of New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1961, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were sitting in the grubby living room of Hester's apartment in Durham, New Hampshire. It was a living room we routinely shared with Hester's roommates, two university girls, who were almost Hester's equal in slovenliness, but sadly, no match for Hester in sex appeal. The girls were not there. They had gone to their parents' homes for Christmas vacation. Hester was not there either. Owen and I would never have discussed my mother's secret life in Hester's presence. Although it was only 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Hester had already consumed several rum and cokes. She was sound asleep in her bedroom, as oblivious to Owen's and my discussion as my mother was.
Let's drive to the gym and practice the shot, said Owen Meany.
I don't feel like it, I said.
Tomorrow is New Year's Day, Owen reminded me. The gym will be closed tomorrow.
From Hester's bedroom, even though the door was closed, we could hear her breathing. Hester's breathing, when she'd been drinking, was something between a snore and a moan. Why does she drink so much? I asked Owen.
Hester's ahead of her time, he said.
What's that mean? I asked him. Do we have a generation of drunks to look forward to?
We have a generation of people who are angry to look forward to, Owen said. And maybe 2 generations of people who don't give a shit, he added.
How do you know? I asked him.
I don't know how I know, said Owen Meany. I just know that I know, he said.
Toronto, June 9, 1987. After a weekend of wonderful weather here, sunny and clear-skied and as cool as it is in the fall, I broke down and bought the New York Times. Thank God, no one I know saw me. One of the Brocklebank daughters got married on the weekend in the Bishop Strawn Chapel. The BSS girls tend to do that. They come back to the old school to tie the knot, even the ones who were miserable when they were students here. Sometimes I'm invited to the weddings. Mrs. Brocklebank invited me to this one, but this particular daughter had managed to escape ever being a student of mine, and I felt that Mrs. Brocklebank invited me only because I ran into her while she was fiercely trimming her hedge. No one sent me a formal invitation. I like to stand on a little ceremony. I felt it wasn't my place to attend. And besides, the Brocklebank daughter was marrying an American. I think it's because I ran into a carload of Americans on Russell Hill Road that I broke down and bought the New York Times. The Americans were lost. They couldn't find the Bishop Strawn School or the chapel. They had a New York license plate and no understanding of how to pronounce Strawn.
"Where's Bishop Strachan?"
a woman asked me. "Bishop Strawn?" I corrected her.
"What?" she said. "I can't understand him," she told her husband, the driver. "I think he's speaking French."
"I was speaking English," I informed the idiot woman. "They speak French in Montreal. You're in Toronto. We speak English here."
"Do you know where Bishop Strachan is?" her husband shouted.
"It's Bishop Strawn," I shouted back.
"No, Strachan," shouted the wife.
One of the kids in the back seat spoke up.
"I think he's telling you how to pronounce it," the kid told his parents.
"I don't want to know how to pronounce it," his father said. "I just want to know where it is."
"Do you know where it is?"
the woman asked me.
"No,"
I said. "I've never heard of it."
"He's never heard of it,"
the wife repeated. She took a letter out of her purse and opened it.
"Do you know where Lonsdale Road is?"
she asked me.
"Somewhere around here," I said. "I think I've heard of that."
They drove off, in the direction of St. Clair and the reservoir. They went the wrong way, of course. Their plans were certainly unclear, but they exhibited an exemplary American firmness. And so I must have been feeling a little homesick. I get that way from time to time. And what a day it was to buy the New York Times. I don't suppose there's ever a good day to buy it, but what a story I read. Nancy Reagan says hearings have not affected president. Oh, boy. Mrs. Reagan said that the congressional hearings on the Iran-Contra deals had not affected the president. Mrs. Reagan was in Sweden to observe a drug abuse program in a high school in a Stockholm suburb. I guess she's one of those many American adults of a certain advanced age who believe that the root of all evil lies in the area of young people's self-abuse. Someone should tell Mrs. Reagan that young people, even young people on drugs, are not the ones responsible for the major problems besetting the world. The wives of American presidents have always been active in eradicating their pet peeves. Mrs. Reagan is all upset about drug abuse. I think it was Mrs. Johnson who wanted to rid the nation of junk cars, those cars that no longer could be driven anywhere but simply sat, rusting into the landscape. They made her absolutely passionate about their removal. And there was another president's wife, or maybe it was a vice president's wife, who thought it was a disgrace how the nation as a whole paid so little attention to art. I forget what it was that she wanted to do about it. But it doesn't surprise me that the president is not affected by the congressional hearings. He hasn't been too affected by what the Congress tells him he can and can't do, either. I doubt that these hearings are going to affect him very greatly. Who cares if he knew, exactly or inexactly, that money raised by secret arms sales to Iran was being diverted to the support of the Nicaraguan rebels? I don't think most Americans care. Americans got bored with hearing about Vietnam before they got out of Vietnam. Americans got bored with hearing about Watergate and what Nixon did or didn't do, even before the evidence was all in. Americans are already bored with Nicaragua. By the time these congressional hearings on the Iran-Contra affair are over, Americans won't know or care what they think, except that they'll be sick and tired of it. After a while, they'll be tired of the Persian Gulf, too. They're already sick to death of Iran. This syndrome is as familiar to me as Hester throwing up on New Year's Eve. It was New Year's Eve, 1963. Hester was vomiting in the Rose Garden, and Owen and I were watching TV. There were 16,300 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. On New Year's Eve in 64, a total of 23,300 Americans were there. Hester was barfing her brains out again. I think the January thaw was early that year. I think that was the year Hester was puking in the rain. But maybe the early thaw was New Year's Eve in 1965, when there were 184,300 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. Hester just threw up. She was nonstop. She was violently opposed to the Vietnam War. She was radically opposed to it. Hester was so ferociously anti-war that Owen Meany used to say that he knew of only one good way to get all those Americans out of Vietnam.
"We should send Hester instead," he used to say. "Hester should drink her way through North Vietnam," Owen would say. "We should send Hester to Hanoi," he told me. "Hester, I've got a great idea," Owen said to her. "Why don't you go throw up on Hanoi instead?"
On New Year's Eve, 1966, there were 385,300 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. 6,644 had been killed in action. Hester and Owen and I weren't together for New Year's Eve that year. I watched the television at 80 Front Street by myself. Somewhere, I was sure, Hester was throwing up, but I didn't know where. In 67, there were 485,600 Americans in Vietnam. 16,021 had been killed there. I watched television at 80 Front Street, alone again. I'd had a little too much to drink myself. I was trying to remember when Grandmother had purchased a color television set, but I couldn't. I'd had enough to drink so that I was sick in the Rose Garden. It was cold enough to make me hope, for Hester's sake, that she was throwing up in a warmer climate. Owen was in a warmer climate. I don't remember where I was or what I did for New Year's Eve in 1968. There were 536,100 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. That was still about 10,000 short of what our peak number would be. Only 30,610 Americans had been killed in action, about 16,000 short of the number of Americans who would die there. Wherever I was for New Year's Eve 1968, I'm sure I was drunk and throwing up. Wherever Hester was, I'm sure she was drunk and throwing up, too. As I've said, Owen didn't show me what he wrote in his diary. It was much later, after everything, after almost everything, when I saw what he'd written there. There is one particular entry I wish I could have read when he wrote it. It is a very early entry, not far from his excited optimism following Kennedy's inauguration, not all that far from his thanking my grandmother for the gift of the diary and his announced intention to make her proud of him. This entry strikes me as important. It is dated January 1, 1962, and it reads as follows.
"I know three things. I know that my voice doesn't change, and I know when I'm going to die. I wish I knew why my voice never changes. I wish I knew how I was going to die. But God has allowed me to know more than most people know, so I'm not complaining. The third thing I know is that I am God's instrument. I have faith that God will let me know what I'm supposed to do and when I'm supposed to do it. Happy New Year."
That was the January of our senior year at Gravesend Academy. If I had understood then that this was his fatalistic acceptance of what he knew, I could have better understood why he behaved as he did, when the world appeared to turn against him, and he hardly raised a hand in his own defense. We were hanging around the editorial offices of The Grave. That year The Voice was also editor-in-chief, when a totally unlikable senior named Larry Lish told Owen and me that President Kennedy was diddling Marilyn Monroe. Larry Lish, Herbert Lawrence Lish Jr., his father was the movie producer Herb Lish, was arguably Gravesend's most cynical and decadent student. In his junior year, he'd gotten a town girl pregnant, and his mother, only recently divorced from his father, had so skillfully and swiftly arranged for the girl's abortion that not even Owen and I knew who the girl was. Larry Lish had spoiled a lot of girls' good times. His mother was said to be ready to fly his girlfriends to Sweden at the drop of a hat. It was rumored that she accompanied the girls, too, just to make sure they went through with it. And after these return trips from Sweden, the girls never wanted to see Larry again. He was a charming sociopath, the kind of creep who makes a good first impression on those poor, sad people who are dazzled by top-drawer accents and custom-made dress shirts. He was witty. Even Owen was impressed by Lish's editorial cleverness for The Grave, and he was cordially loathed by students and faculty alike. I say cordially, in the case of the students, because no one would have refused an invitation to one of his father's or his mother's parties. In the case of the faculty, they exercised a cordial hatred of Lish because his father was so famous that many faculty members were afraid of him, and Lish's mother, the divorcee, was a beauty and a whorish flirt. I'm sure that some of the faculty lived for the glimpse they might get of her on Parents' Day. Many of the students felt that way about Larry Lish's mother, too. Owen and I had never been invited to one of Mr. or Mrs. Lish's parties. New Hampshire natives are not regularly within striking distance of New York City, not to mention Beverly Hills. Herb Lish lived in Beverly Hills. Those were Hollywood parties, and Larry Lish's Gravesend acquaintances who were fortunate enough to come from the Los Angeles area claimed to have met actual starlets at those lavish affairs. Mrs. Lish's Fifth Avenue parties were no less provocative. The seduction and intimidation of young people was an activity both Lishes enjoyed, and the New York girls, although they weren't always aspiring actresses, were reputed to do it with even less resistance than the marginal protestations offered by the California variety. Mr. and Mrs. Lish, following their divorce, were in competition for young Larry's doubtful affection. They had chosen a route to his heart that was strewn with excessive partying and expensive sex. Larry divided his vacations between New York City and Beverly Hills. On both coasts, the segment of society that Mr. and Mrs. Lish knew was comprised of the kind of people who struck many Gravesend Academy seniors as the most fascinating people alive. Owen and I, however, had never heard of most of these people. But we had certainly heard of President John F. Kennedy, and we had certainly seen every movie that starred Marilyn Monroe.
"You know what my mother told me over the vacation?" Larry Lish asked Owen and me.
"Let me guess," I said. "She's going to buy you an airplane."
"And when your father heard about it," said Owen Meany, "he said he'd buy you a villa in France, on the Riviera."
"Not this year," Larry Lish said slyly. "My mother told me that JFK was diddling Marilyn Monroe, and countless others," he added.
"That is a truly tasteless lie," said Owen Meany.
"It's the truth," Larry Lish said, smirking.
"Someone who spreads that kind of rumor ought to be in jail,"
Owen said.
"Can you see my mother in jail?" Lish asked. "This is no rumor. The truth is, the press makes ladies' man Meany look like a virgin. The press gets any woman he wants."
"How does your mother know this?"
Owen asked Lish.
"She knows all the Kennedys," Lish said, after a moderately tense silence. "And my dad knows Marilyn Monroe," he said.
I suppose they do it in the White House?
Owen asked. I know they've done it in New York, Lish said. I don't know where else they've done it. All I know is they've been doing it for years. And when the Prez isn't interested in her anymore, I hear that Bobby's going to get her.
You're disgusting, said Owen Meany.
The world's disgusting, Larry Lish said cheerfully. Do you think I'm lying?
Yes, I do,
Owen said. My mother's going to pick me up and take me skiing next weekend, Lish said. You can ask her yourself. Owen shrugged. Do you think she's lying? Lish asked. Owen shrugged again. He hated Lish, and Lish's mother, or at least he hated the kind of woman he imagined Larry Lish's mother was, but Owen Meany wouldn't have called anyone's mother a liar. Let me tell you, sarcasm master, Larry Lish said. My mother's a gossip, and she's a bitch, but she's not a liar. She doesn't have enough imagination to make anything up. It was one of the more painful things about our peers at Gravesend Academy. It hurt Owen and me to hear how many of our schoolmates commonly put their parents down. They took their parents' money, and they abused their parents' summer houses and weekend retreats when their parents weren't even aware that the kids had their own keys. And they frequently spoke of their parents as if they thought their parents were trash, or at least ignorant beyond saving.
Does Jackie know about Marilyn Monroe?
Owen asked Larry Lish. You can ask my mother, Lish said. The prospect of conversation with Larry Lish's mother was not relaxing to Owen Meany. He brooded all week. He avoided the editorial offices of the Grave, a hangout in which Owen was regularly king. Owen, after all, had been inspired by JFK. Although the subject of the president's personal or sexual morality would not have dampened everyone's enthusiasm for his political ideals and his political goals, Owen Meany was not everyone. Nor was he sophisticated enough to separate public and private morality. I doubt that Owen ever would have become sophisticated enough to make that separation. Not even today, when it seems that the only people who are adamant in their claim that public and private morality are inseparable are those creep evangelists who profess to know that God prefers capitalists to communists and nuclear power to long hair. Where would Owen fit in today? He was shocked that JFK, a married man, could have been diddling Marilyn Monroe, not to mention countless others. But Owen would never have claimed that he knew what God wanted. He always hated the sermon part of the service, of any service. He hated anyone who claimed to know God's opinion of current events. Today, the fact that President Kennedy enjoyed carnal knowledge of Marilyn Monroe and countless others, even during his presidency, seems only moderately improper and even stylish in comparison to the willful secrecy and deception and the unlawful policies so broadly practiced by the entire Reagan administration. The idea of President Reagan getting laid at all by anyone comes only as welcome and comic relief alongside all his other mischief. But 1962 was not today, and Owen Meany's expectations for the Kennedy administration were ripe with the hopefulness and optimism of a 19-year-old who desired to serve his country, to be of use. In the previous spring, the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba had upset Owen. But although that was a disturbing error, it was not adultery.
If Kennedy can rationalize adultery, what else can he rationalize?
Owen asked me. Then he got angry and said,
I'm forgetting he's a mackerel snapper. If Catholics can confess anything, they can forgive themselves anything, too. Catholics can't even get divorced. Maybe that's the problem. It's sick not to let people get divorced.
Look at it this way, I told him. You're president of the United States. You're very good looking. Countless women want to sleep with you. Countless and beautiful women will do anything you ask. They'll even come to the linen service entrance of the White House after midnight.
The linen service entrance? Said Owen Meany.
You know what I mean, I said. If you could fuck absolutely any woman you wanted to fuck, would you or wouldn't you?
I can't believe that your upbringing and your education have been wasted on you, he said. Why study history or literature, not to mention religious knowledge and scripture and ethics? Why not do anything, if the only reason not to is not to get caught? He asked. Do you call that morality? Do you call that responsible? The president is elected to uphold the Constitution. To put that more broadly, he's chosen to uphold the law. He's not given a license to operate above the law. He's supposed to be our example.
Remember that? Remember then? I remember what Owen said about Project 100,000, too. Remember that? That was a draft program outlined by the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, in 1966. Of the first 240,000 taken into the military between 1966 and 1968, 40% read below sixth grade level, 41% were black, 75% came from low-income families, 80% had dropped out of high school. The poor of America have not had the opportunity to earn their fair share of this nation's abundance, Secretary McNamara said, but they can be given an opportunity to serve in this country's defense. That made Owen Meany hopping mad.
Does he think he's doing the poor of America some favor? Owen cried. What he's saying is, you don't have to be white or a good reader to die. That's some opportunity. I'll bet the poor of America are really going to be grateful for this!
Toronto, July 11th, 1987. It's been so hot, I wish Catherine would invite me up to her family's island in Georgian Bay, but she has such a large family, I'm sure she's suffered her share of house guests. I have fallen into a bad habit here. I buy the New York Times almost every day. I don't exactly know why I want or need to know anything more. According to the New York Times, a new poll has revealed that most Americans believe that President Reagan is lying. What they should be asked is, do they care? I wrote Catherine and asked her when she was going to invite me to Georgian Bay. When are you going to rescue me from my own bad habits? I asked her. I wonder if you can buy the New York Times in Pointe-au-Baville Station. I hope not. Larry's mother, Mitzi Lish, had honey-colored, slightly sticky-looking hair. It was coiffed in a bouffant style, and her complexion was much improved by a suntan. In the winter months, when she'd not just returned from her annual pilgrimage to Round Hill, Jamaica, her skin turned a shade sallow. Because her complexion was further wrecked by blotchiness in the extreme cold, and because her excessive smoking had ill-influenced her circulation, a weekend of winter skiing in New England, even to forward the cause of her competition for her son's affection, did not favor either Mrs. Lish's appearance or her disposition. Yet it was impossible not to see her as an attractive older woman. She was not quite up to President Kennedy's standards, but Mitzi Lish was a beauty by any standard Owen and I had to compare her to. Hester's early-blooming eroticism, for example, had not been improved by her carelessness or by alcohol. Even though Mrs. Lish smoked up a storm and her amber hair was dyed because she was graying at her roots, Mrs. Lish looked sexier than Hester. She wore too much gold and silver for New Hampshire. In New York, I'm sure, she was certainly in vogue, but her clothes and her jewelry and her bouffant were more suited to the kind of hotels and cities where evening or formal clothes are standard. In Gravesend, she stood out. And it is hard to imagine that there was a small skier's lodge in New Hampshire or in Vermont that ever could have pleased her. She had ambitions beyond the simple luxury of a private bath. She was a woman who needed room service, who wanted her first cigarette and her coffee and her New York Times before she got out of bed. And then she would need sufficient light and a proper makeup mirror, in front of which she would require a decent amount of time. She would be snappish if ever she was rushed. Her days in New York before lunch, consisted only of cigarettes and coffee in the New York Times, and the patient, loving task of making herself up. She was an impatient woman, but never when applying her makeup. Lunch with a fellow gossip, then, or these days, following her divorce, with her lawyer or a potential lover. In the afternoon, she'd have her hair done, or she'd do a little shopping. At the very least, she'd buy a few new magazines or see a movie. She might meet someone for a drink later. She possessed all the up-to-date information that often passes for intelligence among people who make a daily and extensive habit of the New York Times and the available softer gossip, and she had oodles of time to consume all this contemporary news. She had never worked. She took quite a lot of time for her evening bath, too, and then there was the evening makeup to apply. It irritated her to make any dinner plans that required her presence before 8 o'clock, but it irritated her more to have no dinner plans. She didn't cook, not even eggs. She was too lazy to make real coffee. The instant stuff went well enough with her cigarettes and her newspaper. She would have been an early supporter of those sugar-free diet soft drinks because she was obsessed with losing weight and opposed to exercise. She blamed her troublesome complexion on her ex-husband, who had been stressful to live with, and their divorce had cut her out of California, where she preferred to spend the winter months, where it was better for her skin. She swore her pores were actually larger in New York. But she maintained the Fifth Avenue apartment with a vengeance, and included in her alimony was the expense of her annual pilgrimage to Round Hill, Jamaica, always at a time in the winter when her complexion had become intolerable to her, and a summer rental in the Hamptons, because not even Fifth Avenue was any fun in July and August. A woman of her sophistication, and used to the standard of living she'd grown accustomed to, as Herb Lish's wife and the mother of his only child, simply needed the sun and the salt air. She would be a popular divorcee for quite a number of years. She would appear in no hurry to remarry. In fact, she'd turned down a few proposals. But one year, she would either anticipate that her looks were going, or she would notice that her looks had gone. It would take her more and more time in front of the makeup mirror, simply to salvage what used to be there. Then she would change. She would become quite aggressive on the subject of her second marriage. She realized it was time. Pity whatever boyfriend was with her at this time. He would be blamed for leading her on, and worse, for never allowing her to develop a proper career. There was no honorable course left to him but to marry the woman he had made so dependent on him, whoever he was. She would say he was the reason she'd never stopped smoking, too. By not marrying her, he had made her too nervous to stop smoking. And her oily complexion, formerly the responsibility of her ex-husband, was now the present boyfriend's fault, too. If she was sallow, she was sallow because of him. He was also the cause of her announced depression. Were he to leave her, were he to abandon her, to not marry her, he could at the very least assume the financial burden of maintaining her psychiatrist. Without his aggravation, after all, she would never have needed a psychiatrist. How, you may ask, do I, or did I, know so much about my classmate's unfortunate mother, Mitzi Lish? I told you that Gravesend Academy students were, many of them, very sophisticated, and none of them was more sophisticated than Larry Lish. Larry told everyone everything he knew about his mother. Imagine that. Larry thought his mother was a joke. But in January of 1962, Owen Meany and I were terrified of Mrs. Lish. She wore a fur coat that was responsible for the death of countless small mammals. She wore sunglasses that completely concealed her opinion of Owen and me, although we were sure, somehow, that Mrs. Lish thought we were rusticated to a degree that defied our eventual education. We were sure that Mrs. Lish would rather suffer the agonies of giving up smoking than suffer such boredom as an evening in our company.
"Hello, Mrs. Lish," said Owen Meany. "It's nice to see you again."
"Hello," I said, How are you?
She was the kind of woman who drank nothing but vodka tonics because she cared about her breath. Because of her smoking, she was extremely self-conscious about her breath. Nowadays, she'd be the kind of woman who'd carry one of those breath-freshening atomizers in her purse, gassing herself with the atomizer all day long, just in case someone might be moved to spontaneously kiss her.
"Go on, tell him," Larry Lish said to his mother.
"My son says you doubt that the president fools around," Mrs. Lish said to Owen. When she said fools around, she opened her fur. Her perfume rushed out at us, and we breathed her in.
"Well, let me tell you," said Mitzi Lish. "He fools around. Plenty."
"With Marilyn Monroe?"
Owen asked Mrs. Lish.
"With her, and with countless others," Mrs. Lish said. She wore a little too much lipstick, even for 1962, and when she smiled at Owen Meany, we could see a smear of lipstick on one of her big upper front teeth.
"Does Jackie know?"
Owen asked Mrs. Lish.
"She must be used to it," Mrs. Lish said. She appeared to relish Owen's distress.
"What do you think of that?" she asked Owen. Mitzi Lish was the kind of woman who bullied young men, too.
"I think it's wrong," said Owen Meany.
"Is he for real?" Mrs. Lish asked her son. "Remember that? Remember when people used to ask if you were for real?"
"Isn't he a classic?" Larry Lish asked his mother.
"This is the editor-in-chief of your school newspaper?" Mrs. Lish asked her son. He was laughing.
"That's right," Larry Lish said. His mother really cracked him up.
"This is the valedictorian of your class?" Mitzi Lish asked Larry.
"Yes," Larry said. He couldn't stop laughing.
Owen was so serious about being the valedictorian of our class that he was already writing his commencement speech, and it was only January. In many schools, they don't even know who the class valedictorian is until the spring term. But Owen Meany's grade point average was perfect. No other student was even close.
"Let me ask you something," Mrs. Lish said to Owen. "If Marilyn Monroe wanted to sleep with you, would you let her?"
I thought that Larry Lish was going to fall down. He was laughing so hard. Owen looked fairly calm. He offered Mrs. Lish a cigarette, but she preferred her own brand. He lit her cigarette for her, and then he lit one for himself. He appeared to be thinking over the question very carefully.
"Well, come on," Mrs. Lish said seductively. "We're talking Marilyn Monroe. We're talking the most perfect piece of ass you can imagine. Or don't you like Marilyn Monroe?"
She took off her sunglasses. She had very pretty eyes, and she knew it.
"Would you, or wouldn't you?"
she asked Owen Meany. She winked at him, and then, with the painted nail of her long index finger, she touched him on the tip of his nose.
"Not if I were the president," Owen said, "and certainly not if I were married."
Mrs. Lish laughed. It was something between a hyena and the sounds Hester made in her sleep when she'd been drinking.
"This is the future?" Mitzi Lish asked. "This is the head of the class of the country's most prestigious fucking school? And this is what we can expect of our future leaders?"
"No, Mrs. Lish, I can answer you now. This was not what we could expect of our future leaders. This was not where our future would lead us. Our future would lead us elsewhere, and to leaders who bear little resemblance to Owen Meany." But at the time, I was not bold enough to answer her. Owen, however, was no one anyone could bully. Owen Meany accepted what he thought was his fate, but he would not tolerate being treated lightly.
"Of course, I'm not the president,"
Owen said shyly.
"And I'm not married, either. I don't even know Marilyn Monroe, of course," he said. "And she probably wouldn't ever want to sleep with me, but you know what?"
he asked Mrs. Lish, who was, with her son, overcome with laughter.
"If you wanted to sleep with me, I mean now, when I'm not the president and I'm not married, what the hell?"
Owen said to Mitzi Lish.
"I suppose I'd try it."
Have you ever seen dogs choke on their food? Dogs inhale their food. They're quite dramatic chokers. I never saw anyone stop laughing as quickly as Mrs. Lish and her son. They stopped cold.
"What did you say to me?"
Mrs. Lish asked Owen.
"Well, come on," said Owen Meany. "Would you or wouldn't you?"
He didn't wait for an answer. He shrugged. We were standing in the dry, dusty stink of cigarettes that was the commonplace air in the editorial offices of the Grave, and Owen simply walked over to the coat tree and removed his red and black checkered hunter's cap and his jacket of the same well-worn material. Then he walked out in the cold, which so ill affected Mrs. Lish's troublesome complexion. Larry Lish was such a coward, he never said a word to Owen, nor did he jump on Owen's back and pound Owen's head into the nearest snowbank. Either Larry was a coward, or he knew that his mother's honor was not worth such a robust defense. In my opinion, Mitzi Lish was not worth a defense of any kind. But our headmaster, Randy White, was a chivalrous man. He was a gallant of the old school when it came to defending the weaker sex. Naturally, he was outraged to hear of Owen.